listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The American higher educational system is facing challenges like never before, an ongoing battle over academic freedom, tenured professors becoming an endangered species, and tuition price tags now at $40,000 and up. But does that signal the end of higher education as we know it? Ellen Schrecker, who is a professor of history at Yeshiva University, looks into the matter in her latest book, The Lost Soul of Higher Education, Corporatization, the Assault on Academic Freedom, and the End of the American University. It's published by the New Press, and I'm pleased that it brings her back to our show today. Hello. And your subtitle kind of suggests where we're going to be going with this conversation. What do you think, what do you see as the greatest threat to American universities today?
The greatest threat, I'm afraid, is something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, which is the disappearance of the faculty. What we're seeing in American higher education has been an ongoing process, 30, 40 years or so, of completely restructuring American institutions of higher education so that today, that faculty member that people remembered with the tweed jackets and the suede patches and the tenure now represents something like 25% of all the instructional personnel within American higher education.
The rest are per diem?
Not quite per diem yet. These are people who are what we call contingent faculty members. They have part-time jobs. They're on short-term contracts. They can be fired or let go at any time for any reason, for no reason at all. They have no academic freedom, and their increasing numbers are actually threatening the quality of American higher education.
Well, you brought up the matter of tenure, which is a really touchy subject today. When we argue over tenure in the public schools, are we arguing over something different than we are when we're talking about universities?
I think the two are, what should we say, first cousins. Academic freedom within the American university is a fairly, it's been around about 100 years or so. And what it does is protect college teachers in the performance of their academic duties, their teaching, their research, and the administrative tasks that these people have to perform in order to maintain their teaching and research.
Isn't one of the problems with tenure that it not only protects the good professors, but also the bad ones, the ones that the students hate and don't really want to take classes with?
Students can hate very good professors because they're
making them work. But I know what you're talking about, Ellen.
I
went to school, and I remember when we were registering for classes and the word would go out, This one is a real bore. This one has very rigid positions. This one has certain kinds of ideas that he imposes on his students. And yet that person was protected by tenure.
Okay. What tenure ideally does is protect people against being fired arbitrarily, against losing their jobs for no reasons. In a working academic system, professors who do not fulfill their responsibilities, who clearly are coasting and not paying attention to their students, they can lose their jobs, but there have to be a set of procedures followed, especially including procedures that are being handled by a quasi-judicial body of faculty peers. This ensures academic freedom.
There's also the other side of tenure. Often favoritism leads to people getting tenure. It isn't always the best people who are given it, but the ones who have friends within the department.
Or friends within the administration.
Yeah. I have a friend who, at one school, who got recommendation letters from a lot of famous people. His department head said, well, just because Susan Sontag wrote a recommendation doesn't mean that you're going to get tenure. And he didn't.
Yeah. One of the things that tenure does do, which is very interesting, is protect the quality of higher education. When somebody is being hired for a tenure slot, there should be, and at most schools there often is, a national search. The school, at my school, we just had one. We had 200 applicants for one job, and we picked an absolutely fabulous young academic who we certainly hope is going to get tenure. And then about 6 years from now, we're going to look at him very closely. And that is a much more rigorous process of evaluation than people get in any other field.
In the past, you've come here to talk about McCarthyism. And of course, that was a tenure and academic freedom were a big issue in the 50s. But they haven't gone away. Was there a time when professors had more academic freedom than they do now?
Probably not. But what has occurred is that in the 1950s, and I wrote a book about universities during the McCarthy period, when about 100 faculty members, many of them with tenure, were fired for political reasons. What's happened then in the 1960s, which was a period of enormous unrest on American campuses, and many people did lose their jobs for political reasons at that time. But, and this is what's different today, during the 1960s, the American academic system was expanding enormously. It doubled, triple in size. New colleges were being founded. Little teachers' colleges were becoming universities. And so many people who were being fired could get a job somewhere else. And so that really mitigated the problem. Today, the jobs market is terrible. And if somebody loses a job for political reasons, that's the end of that person's career.
Well, what about a case like Ward Churchill? Do we want somebody like that teaching our kids, a man who claimed that the 9/11 attacks were a natural and unavoidable consequence of what he sees as unlawful U.S. policy? And in an essay, he referred to the technocratic core working at the World Trade Center as little Eichmanns. I don't know if I want my kid in that guy's class.
Well, the problem with academic freedom is that there are always these tough cases, the Ward Churchills, the people who I call squeaky wheels. And to a certain extent, these people have to be protected. It's hard. It's not popular. But in order to ensure that somebody isn't fired because of that person's extracurricular political activities, if it doesn't affect that person's academic responsibilities and academic fitness, then that person needs to be retained. We have in cases, there's one professor at Northwestern University who is a Holocaust denier. Now, somebody like that should not be teaching European history. This guy, however, is an engineer, and he's kept his job, and he's been defended by the American University of American Association of University Professors, which is the watchdog organization for academic freedom, and he's been defended by his university as well.
But what would happen if he were teaching history and he were tenured?
Well, hopefully he wouldn't have been appointed. One of the problems—
Definitely not at your school, Yeshiva University.
Definitely not. But one of the big problems that we're seeing, and one of the reasons why tenure is being attacked so much, is that many institutions are not very careful with regard to the hiring and tenuring of professors. And we need to really look at that as well as some of the other problems, the main one being what I would call the casualization of academic labor.
And we'll address that in just a moment. My guest is Ellen Schrecker, professor of history at Yeshiva University. He's written extensively about the Cold War Red Scare and has been a guest on our show to talk about that. Her latest book is The Lost Soul of Higher Education, Corporatization, The Assault on Academic Freedom, and the End of the American University, published by the New Press. Stay with us for more. We're back with Ellen Schrecker, whose latest book is The Lost Soul of Higher Education, Corporatization, The Assault on Academic Freedom, and the End of the American University, published by the New Press. today's universities have skyrocketing tuition costs and are more competitive than ever. How did we get here?
Oh, man, it's a long story and not a very pleasant one. What happened was up until the late 1960s, the academic community was expanding. There was research money. My scientist friends were getting money thrown at them. Everything was just great. And then in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a financial crunch. All of a sudden, universities discovered that they were having problems, that they couldn't afford it. And what was more serious was that state legislatures, which had been funding public higher education, began to pull back. Now, they never reduced the actual amounts they were giving, but the percentage of university budgets that were being covered by state legislatures began to shrink.
Was that in response to budget crunches, or was it – what about the fact that some people in the legislatures and in Congress – object to certain teachers being at certain schools or certain tendencies? There's been a lot of talk about just too many liberals in our universities.
I think that's part of it, but I think it's much more a financial problem. State legislatures have to have a balanced budget.
Now, this is not unique to the United States. Students are rioting in England because of increased tuition costs.
Well, what began to happen, which is really interesting, is the burden began to shift from the state taxpayers to individual students. And their tuitions began to be paid by the federal government through loans, through Pell Grants, so that what we're seeing is schools now struggling to increase their enrollment so they can get those tuition dollars that the state legislatures no longer are giving them. I'll tell you one story. A former president of the University of Michigan, describing what had happened, said, well, we used to be state supported. Then we were state located. Now we're We used to be state supported. Then we were state assisted. Now we're state located.
It's just the name Michigan.
Exactly. The University of Virginia is already thinking about becoming a private institution.
You mentioned the casualization of academia. What's that?
That's the transformation of the faculty and of faculty jobs from full-time tenure-track jobs to part-time, very insecure jobs as adjuncts who have no academic freedom and can be fired for things, believe it or not, like grading too hard.
Well, they also don't get paid very well. So does that mean there isn't stability in many departments?
They certainly don't get paid. The average is somewhere around it goes from about $1,500 to $3,000 a course, which means that you can't survive as an adjunct unless you have a whole bunch of classes. Often they have to be at different schools, and you've got the creation of what are known in California as freeway flyers, people who don't have offices. Some of them have to hold their office hours and meet students in their cars in the college parking lots. And these people have no job security. They can't do research. Many of them are extremely talented teachers who just had bad luck in the job market.
Well, there is this. We just talked about how the schools are experiencing a serious budget crunch. So it's understandable that they would want to have a system in which they could pay many of the instructors less. They don't have to pay medical insurance and all of the other things that come with full-time jobs.
Exactly. And what's really interesting and I think rather sad is the fact that very recently, I think it was this September, the percentage of administrative employees in the nation's system of higher education is higher than that of its instructional staff.
Are the schools suffering from lower enrollment? Today, I guess the general feeling is that you can't get a decent job unless you have a college education.
No, they're not suffering from lower enrollment at all. Their students are flocking to institutions of higher education, especially community colleges and sort of locally smaller public institutions.
The ones where the students don't have to pay a high tuition.
Yeah. And what is happening is that classes are growing. Classes are being canceled because they don't even have the space to put these students into them. And it's an altogether bad situation.
But you also say that today's universities are consumer driven. What do you mean by that?
Students are going to universities to get a job. You can't survive in anywhere near a middle class standard of life without a college degree. And students are vocationally driven. What can you get with a English degree? What can you get with a BA in history or mathematics? So they're going into fields like sports management, occupational therapy, whatever, which is not necessarily wise.
On the other hand, I remember complaints when I was going to school that the university really didn't prepare us for life after the university. We would be talking about all these high-flown ideas with teachers who had never really worked in the private sector.
Yeah.
And then we went out there and found that the world was quite different from what we had been taught.
Well, I think that certainly still happens, but also one of the problems is that you can be trained and get your degree in MRI technology and then discover 3 years down the pike that they're changing the technology.
When I went to school, a lot of teachers complained about the pressure to publish. Has that changed at all?
Yes. Now you can't even get hired at some schools if you haven't published a book. People expecting tenure, according to the Modern Language Association, now not only need to have a book already published, but quote-unquote substantial progress toward the second book. And what's happening, which makes the situation even worse, is that the university presses that were publishing people's books are themselves under enormous financial pressure and cutting back, especially in fields that aren't very popular.
So if funding has dried up, at least for state institutions, from the legislatures, where's the money coming from? Who's paying for the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor these days?
People who can afford the full tuition. Many of these state institutions are skewing their admissions toward out-of-state students who can pay higher tuitions. Schools are looking for any source of income they can find. They're licensing their logos if they have winning sports teams, and they're trying to get private corporations to fund their research. And this can be a serious problem, especially in certain scientific fields.
Because the pressure is for them to come up with answers that satisfy the corporation or the government or whoever is funding that research.
Yes, and not only that, there are corporations are often under pressure to make money. If it looks like somebody's research isn't going to pan out, they'll pull the plug. Or if it turns out to be unfavorable to the corporation, they'll simply censor it. And this is a problem for many scientists that corporations put in their contracts with university researchers clauses banning publication up to a certain point.
So here we are. We've talked about this terrible situation, and your subtitle concludes with the end of the American university. Where do we go from here?
Okay, it's pretty gloomy, isn't it? But I actually see some hope. Several years ago, you may recall, a conservative activist named David Horowitz was peddling something he called the Academic Bill of Rights to a number of state legislatures, which would have required a kind of political test for employment, an absolute violation of academic freedom. And universities and their faculties became very upset, went, lobbied their state legislatures. And once the state legislators realized, understood what was at stake, they defeated Horowitz's initiative. And I think what we see is the American people themselves do want a good system of higher education. They're probably willing to support it if they can only understand what it is that they're supporting.
You don't write about Bennington, but a listener, Chris, left this comment on a show page. He said, please discuss the elimination of tenure at Bennington College in 1994. They fired many good professors and steered the college hard to the right. Do you know about that?
Yes. What happened was they had a very activist president who decided to get rid of tenure. Anybody who could leave left. And this is one of the advantages of tenure.
But isn't Bennington still one of the most respected schools in America?
It may be. It's a very unique school because its faculty are mainly practicing artists, and that's what she wanted. But people in the government department, in the English department, left because now they're benefiting, of course, from this terrible job market where there are 200 applicants for every job. So even a terrible job at a school like Bennington looks good rather than adjuncting.
So you're saying that there are a lot of people looking for jobs, which means that a hire usually means that you can get somebody pretty good. I'm worried about all those other people, who would have been working at schools in the past. What are they doing now?
What are they doing? Well, they're adjuncting. They're struggling. Many of them are on food stamps. And if I have students, wonderful students who are interested in going into higher education, I often try to dissuade them. It's a terrible situation for faculty, and it hurts their students.
Well, along those lines, a listener left this comment. NYU adjuncts get less than $1,400. Great folks, but the turnover is way too high to get the value of a seasoned teacher that you'd expect. And this isn't an advanced professional program.
The problem with adjuncts is not only do they not have the facilities for office hours, but they lack the continuity. So that a student, for example, who would like to get a letter of recommendation from a former teacher is no longer there. Another problem is that because these people have no job security, they depend very heavily on good student evaluations. And we happen to know that the best indicator of good student evaluations is high grades. So these people are literally lowering the standards of higher education, not because they're bad teachers, but because they are so insecure.
Ellen Schrecker is a professor of history at Yeshiva University. She has written a number of books, No Ivory Tower, The Age of McCarthyism, Many Are the Crimes, and Cold War Triumphalism. She's a former editor of the American Association of University Professors magazine, Academe. And her latest book is The Lost Soul of Higher Education, Corporatization, The Assault on Academic Freedom, and The End of the American University. It's published by the New Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.